not always going to make everybody happy. Libertarians are impossible to make happy. Because I've been accused of silencing their poor little voices.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, we'll talk about art as a means to move people out of the margins and into view, about getting your picture taken at the Reason Rally, and about peer-reviewed rap music. Art has the potential to reach people in ways no simple argument can. As such, it's always been harnessed for activist pursuits. From design that adds impact to a message, to providing the sugar coating on an educational pill, to telling us stories we need to hear, activism needs art. Humanist activism is no exception. On this week's show, we talk to two artists whose art exists for far more than art's sake. Stephanie Zavan talks to Josiah Mannion about his photography and his motto, "I take pictures of humans, this is my humanism." Kim Ellington talks with Baba Brinkman about his album, The Rap Guide to Religion, and about having his work peer-reviewed by scientists. I would like to welcome to the show Josiah Mannion. Josiah is an atheist and humanist activist and a photographer out of Omaha, and he joins us today to talk about art and activism. Welcome, Josiah.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about how you came to be a humanist activist. You have a slightly unusual religious background.
Yeah, I was raised a kind of an odd combination of High Church Episcopalian and Pentecostal Catholic.
And explain how that works.
We went to one church and we belonged to another community. And the community that we belonged to wouldn't have called itself Catholic, but it was based in a movement called Pentecostal Catholicism, which was a thing for a while. So we went to one church and the other one did not claim to be a church, didn't want to be a church, but it was a community of people, and the largest portion of them were Catholic. I mean, it had the speaking in tongues, it had spiritual discipleship and all that kind of stuff. So I grew up in those environments and then went off to college, and somewhere in college then I became Russian Orthodox and had every intention of becoming a priest and a theologian, which obviously didn't work out.
What happened?
I went into the army and I spent 5 years there telling people that I was deeply religious and spiritual, but wasn't very good at it because I would, you know, say cuss words all the time, stuff like that, because it's the army and that's what you do. And then after I got out, I came back to Nebraska, and the friends that I found myself among, you know, my tribe, so to speak, all happened to be non-believers of one stripe or another. And they made it comfortable for me to actually confront all of the questions that I'd had for, you know, 15 years or so.
And I assume these questions were slightly more substantial than feeling bad because you were cussing.
Yes. Yeah, they got me to a place where it was comfortable to actually just go through and, you know, and take all of the things that I'd gotten from all of the dogmatic theology, the apologetic theology, and so on, and go down the list and go, all right, does this actually work? And after a while, it didn't work. I was still kind of uncomfortable with the idea of calling myself an atheist, so I made myself a deal. I was like, okay, well, I'm going to try it on for a month and see where we're at. And at the end of that month, far from actually having tried something on, it felt like I'd taken something restrictive off, and I was actually in my own skin for the first time. And that was great. But I mean, along with that did come those actual making of lists and going, okay, does this argument for the existence of God actually work? No, it really doesn't, if I'm being honest with myself. And does this one work? Well, this one works a little bit better than the other one, but it still doesn't really work. And so I then began to get involved in the atheist community here in Omaha and haven't really looked back.
And it wasn't the organized atheist community in Omaha that made it possible for you to do this question.
No, it was just that little group of friends. And they were the ones that made it comfortable for me to ask those questions. Initially, I was a little bit turned off from the atheist community in Omaha, not through any fault of theirs, but just because of the kind of person I am. When I first went to a meeting, they were doing like mixer stuff, organized mixer stuff, and that's not, I don't like that. I just wanted to sit back and watch, and they didn't make it possible for me to do that. And so I was like, screw you guys, I'm going home. And it took about another year before I started coming back around.
What made you decide to become an activist rather than just going to the occasional meeting?
Paying attention is the short version. The longer version of that kind of goes into having to, once I became an atheist, having to actually reevaluate everything that I had ever thought about the world. Because for me, religion was not a thing, you know, as for so many people, it was not a thing that you just went and did once a week and then the rest of your life was kind of separate and you led your life and then you went to church on Sunday and did stuff. It was a completely comprehensive worldview. And once I'd lost that worldview, I had to reevaluate the way that I looked at the world. And so everything began then to get reevaluated. And as I went through that process, it became clear to me, you know, that the way that I looked at women, the way that I looked at, or the way, not the way that I looked even necessarily, but the way that my religion had told me what the place of women is in the world was wrong. And I had to relook at that. And then from there, then you began to see, okay, well, it's not just that, because you can't isolate that. Then that is connected to all of these other forms of marginalization. And so I began to read and get familiar with feminist theory and then intersectionalist theory and looking at all of those things. And so marginalization as a whole began to be what was really important, but that was all deeply connected to, organically connected to my atheism. So when people try and go dictionary atheist on me, I can see how people can section those things off in their head, but it doesn't really work for me because that's all connected to me.
All right. And how did you end up taking pictures? Because you're relatively new to that for a professional photographer.
Yeah, all things told. Art has always been a part of my life in one way or another, and whether it's been drawing or writing or taking pictures. And so it's not that I had never done photography before, but when I came back to Omaha after the Army, I went through a whole bunch of stuff and then eventually went into treatment for being an alcoholic. And once I got out of there, I needed something to give me an artistic anchor in the world, and photography was that thing, and I picked it up and I started taking pictures. And then that gradually became more and more central to how I saw the world and what I was doing in the world, and a way that I could watch the world and still help create it. Because often I'm much more comfortable on, you know, on the edges and on the fringes of things and watching it. But if I was taking pictures, then that gave me a way to also help form the world rather than just sitting back and watching it.
So let's delve a little bit into what you mean when you're talking about forming the world. You have a Patreon, and a couple months ago at this point, you put out a post called Art as Activism. And you've always had as your tagline for as long as I've been aware of you, which is a few years now, you take pictures of humans. This is your humanism.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that you see yourself doing when you're taking pictures that is activism?
One of the things that artists are so very, very good at doing, artists of all kinds, not just one or another, pretty much no matter what your art is, one of the things that artists do is look at the things that other people don't see and make them seen. So we'd look on the edges, on the peripheries, and we see the things that other people don't see and we make them visible. So it is, then, to borrow Bell Hooks' phrase, we try and move those things from the margin to the center, from the edges of people's visions, and put them in front of them so that we're not the only people seeing it, so that other people are seeing it too. And to me, that is literally a form of demarginalization, because you are taking the things that other people aren't seeing because they're on the periphery of their visions, and you're putting them right in the middle so people can see them. And not only are we doing that as artists, but so often what we're doing when we're doing that is we're finding the beauty in those things, and we're putting them in front of other people's eyes as specifically something that is beautiful and human. And when we do that, it takes people from being kind of seen as flat to being seen as more three-dimensional and whole and human, so that their existence can be recognized as something other than a caricaturization or something that's flat. And so when we do that, it is a way of giving people a fully dimensional reality that other people don't necessarily see them as having.
I will come back to that idea of making people visible in a moment, but you brought up beauty just now, and in that essay, you talk a little bit about having a fairly complicated concept of what beauty is. And since that's such an abstract concept and means so many different things to so many different people, you want to tell me what that means to you?
It's been one of those things that has operated as a touchstone for me throughout my life. And I've always hated the idea of word tattoos, but if I was ever going to get a word tattoo, it would be Dostoevsky's quote, "Beauty will save the world." And even when I was religious, that was a very important quote to me. And after I left religion, or after shed religion, it continues to be an idea that's very important to me. And beauty can be very messy and very complicated. And it's not always simple and clean as a picture of a rose or something. You know, those are beautiful too, but beauty can have a dark edge to it. It can be very messy. It can be very complicated. And when you take art, rather than trying to clean it off, the thing that the art is about, rather than trying to clean it off and make it simple and do that, sometimes it's far more powerful for it to be reflective of the complicated messiness of reality. That's something that's depicted in a lot of the work that I've seen Dr. Monica Miller do with hip hop, is that, you know, she talks about it being a reflection and a refraction of the lived reality of all of these people. And it's not necessarily clean. It's going to have these elements of different ugly things in it, but it's reflective of a reality that they are living and experiencing. And to me, that is part of maintaining beauty. Beauty should be reflective. It's part of it being honest. And if you are going to present people as being real, and if you're going to try and depict their humanity, it's not always going to look polished and pretty and cute. Sometimes it is going to be messy and it's going to be ugly. But that reality is far more beautiful than a polished picture might be.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan, and I'm speaking with Josiah Mannion about photography as a form of activism. You mentioned that you prefer, frequently, standing on the edges yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, it can be very uncomfortable, because sometimes I get more. Being invisible can be very comfortable. It's useful as a photographer, not being seen. But doing that doesn't always allow one to stay as invisible as you'd like.
And how about the fact that you are taking other people who are on the margins? Some of them may be there by choice. How do you make decisions about who you pull into view and into focus?
A very constant push and pull there. You know, it's a question that I've had to ask myself. I've taken a specific example. It's a short series of pictures that I love and I'm very, very proud of, and I can't show anybody because it was taken in a situation where they were talking about something, and if I were to take that and put it out in public, it could out them to people that they don't want to be out to, or that they can't be out to, or it's dangerous for them to be out to. Yeah, those are questions that I have to constantly struggle with. There's very much a tension there. Some of that is the tension, you know, between street photography, where you're taking, for instance, where you're taking pictures of people and they're not necessarily aware that you're there. And they're not necessarily aware that their picture is taken. There's ethical questions, you know, to be asked about permission and consent. When is it okay and when is it not okay? When is the shield of public space, when can that be used? And when should you ask? When should you gain consent? And sometimes that can be done after the fact, and you show them a picture and they're like, oh my God, that's really beautiful. Yeah, publish it. And then you get the best of both worlds, because you have a picture where they weren't aware of you taking their picture, but they love it and they want you to put it out there.
And I assume this is particularly a consideration when you're taking pictures of marginalized populations who haven't historically controlled their own images, their own use.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that comes up when we talk about particularly images as activism is, for example, the concept of disability porn, where we have people whose lives are being portrayed in ways that they wouldn't necessarily conceive of their own lives.
Yeah, because we talk about, you know, having platforms and giving microphones, and if you're actually going to give a microphone to somebody, you don't get to be the one whose voice is heard. If you're giving someone a microphone, and it's their voice that needs to be heard. And I think in photography, anyway, that can be a tricky position to try and maintain, but it can be done. And a lot of that does have to do with actually taking the time rather than just taking their images and telling a story that you imagine around it, and taking an image and then letting them speak in that image, you know, whether it's through a story that they tell or just the image itself. It's something that you're trying to do is not impose a narrative on them, but rather let them reveal their own narrative.
Now, we've been talking about marginalized communities generally. What are some of the communities in which you take pictures that you are specifically looking to make people see people in these communities as they are?
I've done a lot of work in atheist communities and just trying to, you know, let the world see our community and all of the kind of humanity and vibrancy that it has, that it can be very ordinary, and it can be very beautiful, you know, like dramatically beautiful. But then also, even within the atheist communities, to try and pay attention to marginalized communities there, women, people of color, let them have a presence in our community too, because the atheist community has long been dominated by the white boy, and white boys don't need any more microphones. We've got enough.
And outside the atheist communities?
There's a lot of, you know, nerd and geek culture, but even beyond that, because I was homeless for a couple of years ago, I guess it was. And I would take their pictures too and sit in the middle of them and live their lives. And we would tell each other stories, but it was an extremely interesting experience. So there too, the, you know, economically marginalized people. So yeah, I mean, really it comes down to not this or that community, but just the way that you see the world. You're constantly looking towards the edges, and you're trying to find the people, no matter where you are, the people that are on the edges that aren't being heard, and trying to bring a little bit more vibrancy and dimensionality to their recognized existences so that they don't feel silenced, they don't feel unheard, and trying to do that in as many ways as possible. Not always going to make everybody happy. Libertarians are impossible to make happy because I've been accused of silencing their poor little voices. So it's the...
Wait, you have obligations to libertarians. That's what they're telling you?
To not silence their voices so that they don't feel irrelevant. Yeah, I've been told that. That I was doing that.
Okay.
That's a hard thing for me to reconcile. Like, I can't.
Yeah, I'm having trouble reconciling that with their philosophy too. Okay, I just had to make sure that was what you were telling me.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a funny example, but it's just, and maybe it's funny because it kind of got to me at the time. I was like, well, shoot, what am I doing here? Like, am I? I don't know. maybe it's a good thing to be aware of. But in that particular case, I have a hard time having a whole lot of sympathy.
You don't feel like they're standing on the margins?
I don't.
Okay. So going back to taking pictures within the atheist community, are there themes and stories that you find yourself telling repeatedly?
Yes, and it's twofold. One is trying to bring humanity to atheists, and so bring humanism to atheists, like a broader outside world view of atheists, and letting them see that just people, and that it's not whatever demonized version of an atheist that they might have. And usually their picture of atheist isn't as clear as they think it is. They do have a pretty one-dimensional view of atheists and atheism a lot of the time. So it's trying to do that. But it's also trying to, and this is bringing an awareness within atheism and to an outside perspective of atheism as well, that it's not just the white boy club, that there are so many other people, and those people have voices and existences that need to be recognized as completely as real and valid as the white boy version of reality, which very often the white boy then takes as a challenge to their own existence. After all, if someone is as real as them, they can't be real somehow. So there, that's, you know, bringing a challenge to other people to grant a much richer texture, a much richer reality than the kind of bland version that we've had for so many years.
You've given voice to a certain number of objections to your work. How many of these are objections that you get directly? How much is this people looking at your work and telling you that you're doing something wrong by doing this?
Huh. It's not, I mean, I have had direct objections voiced, but it's not really so much that as people objecting to, you know, an intersectional position. So taking objection to that position from which I'm operating. And because that's a position that I share, I mean, taking the objections to AHA's revitalized platforms of late, because I operate from a similar perspective, when people raise objections to that, they're raising objections also to the perspective from which I operate.
Got it. So let's talk a little bit about Reason Rally.
Mm-hmm.
Reason Rally first happened in 2012, happening again this year. I expect it'll keep happening during presidential years as long as people keep forgetting that atheists exist and are voters. The first Reason Rally didn't have a coordinated attempt to capture it on film, but there were people there who took pictures, and you mentioned a project that is in process. Is that something you can talk about at this point?
I know that Bruce Press and Ingrid Loss have a book that will be available at the Reason Rally that is a documentation of the previous Reason Rally, and I personally can't wait to see it. I think it's going to be fantastic. But yes, this time we have a much more coordinated effort to try and document it, and we are doing things like having an eye towards diversity. We're not going to be just taking pictures of the white boys because they're the easiest people to take pictures of. We are very much trying to be the change that we want to see, so to speak. So it's gone from last time not having a coordinated effort to document it and have a history of it to this time being incredibly coordinated on multiple fronts. So not just still photography, but there's also a fantastic AV team that's been put together that's going to be documenting it. They're going to be live streaming it. There's all kinds of ways to make sure that this gets out there into public consciousness and stays there. And on multiple levels and in multiple ways and for multiple reasons. So not just our representation of ourselves, but our representation to the wider world so that, you know, people don't forget that non-believers of one stripe or another form a very significant voting block, and that those humanist values should be taken to heart, not just during major presidential cycles, but also, you know, the smaller cycles too. And people are starting to get involved in down-ticket races and putting their names out there for school boards and those kinds of things.
We're keeping our eyes on several congressional races at the moment.
Yes.
We're not interviewing any of them just yet because we're walking a fine line with politics already, but we're keeping an eye on them. We'll probably talk to them after November.
Yeah. And to me, the various ways that we can, you know, tell those stories, whether it's through photography, whether it's through interviews, whether it's through all the different kinds of storytelling techniques that we as artists and journalists and whatnot have, the more that those are out there, the more richly textured a view of the existence of this gigantic block of people can be.
What kinds of things are you specifically making sure you cover at Reason Rally?
Yeah, well, I mean, the standard stuff. We have to have stage, and but we also have backstage. We're going to be documenting the efforts of the volunteers that go into this.
Okay. As somebody who has coordinated volunteers and been a volunteer, thank you. Thank you so much. Okay, go on.
So, yeah, that's going to be there. So it's not just going to be the stars. It's not just going to be the green room. The biggest block of it on Reason Rally Day is all the different areas of crowd coverage, because we want to be out there showing that too. The stage is, relatively speaking, a pretty minor portion of what we're actually going to be focusing lenses on. Well, and protests, like that's a slot too. We have that. So that will be there. So if Ray Comfort decides to get out there, we'll take pictures of it, sure.
And the counter protests, because those will be entertaining.
And the counter protests too, because if Ed can get out, or whoever Ed inspires, maybe, hopefully, wink, wink, to put on a banana costume and go talk to Ray Comfort, we'll make sure there's pictures.
Okay, now I'm worried about incitement, but as long as it's a banana costume, I think we're okay.
All of the work that's gone in to go from in 2012, you know, not having an organized effort at all to document the Reason Rally, to having this incredibly organized team of people that's going to be out there taking pictures and organizing. And I mean, we had another 2-hour meeting last night, kind of cobbling together some of the last minute details and making sure we got everything covered and going over schedules. And when we're out there, we'll be out there talking to each other and making sure that everything is covered.
So what you're saying is, even though you're standing on the sidelines, and we may not be noticing you, it's not because you haven't put in the effort.
Yes, we've put a lot of work into this, and Bruce in particular has been an absolutely amazing collaborator and has really stepped up to kind of be the focal point of the organization and make sure that everything has gone well. And Bruce and Ingrid have been amazing to work with, and it's been awesome. I really enjoyed it. Never thought I would enjoy working with a team of photographers this much. Because oftentimes, you know, it feels like it's a lone thing. You're off by yourself. You want to be on the fringes. You don't want to be noticed. You just want to take pictures. And so having this kind of organization go into it has been fantastic. And I really hope I get to do stuff like this again, working with other photographers and making things happen. It's really cool.
It's worth stepping out of the margins for.
Yeah, it's worth stepping out a little bit for, definitely.
So I mentioned that you have a Patreon. For those who don't know, it's a crowdfunding source that allows people who, I hate to use the phrase content creators, but that's really how broad the platform is. It covers writers and photographers, obviously, and various kinds of artists and people who make videos, all that kind of stuff. Why did you decide to set up a Patreon? What does it allow you to do?
What it has allowed me to do is begin to gather a little bit more resources so that I can do things like go to conferences. I mean, literally what it has done is help to give me the resources to be able to get to conferences and take the pictures and do the kinds of pictures that I want to take.
If you're not there, is anybody else taking these pictures?
Increasingly so, yes. What I can't say is that they have the same goals as I do. A lot of the times when you have photographers there, they are paying more attention to photographing the celebrities and the speakers and who's there, because that's exciting. But what that means is that the people that are on their margins, they stay there. And when I go to a conference, those are specifically the things that I'm looking for. I'm still going to take pictures of the person on stage, but in reality, there's only so many unique pictures that you can take of a person on stage. That's, you know, you do three or four of those, you pretty much got it covered. Like, there's not a whole lot else to do, which also serves that need to wander. That serves me well there. And now, if it's a particularly interesting topic, then I might sit and listen to the speaker the whole time. Other than that, it allows me to satisfy that need to wander and to look for the people who are having conversations in a corner. The hall con, so to speak, is at every conference, people talk about there's the conference, and then there's the hall conference. And that hall conference is a really exciting thing to be a part of and to get to go out and take pictures of. And I like to be able to do that.
And for people who haven't done a lot of hall con at conferences, that's where things get planned.
Yes.
About half your organizations and almost all of your various projects in the movement have started out at a hall con somewhere.
Yes. And it's fun to watch the seeds of those when they happen. And then, you know, a year later or 2 years later, this thing pops up and you were like, oh, I remember when they started talking about that. That's very cool.
You also mentioned geek communities as a marginalized community. And I don't think at this point that a lot of people are going to think of geeks as a marginalized community anymore. The Marvel Cinematic Universe has seen to that, if nothing else.
It's true. Yeah.
What is it that you're looking for when you're taking pictures? So, for example, you're coming up to Convergence here in Minneapolis in early July.
Yes, which I'm thoroughly excited.
What is it that you are looking for in pictures among the geek community? What is it that you're trying to show people outside that community?
You know, to a large extent, I think that is parallel to the kinds of stories that I want to tell when I'm going to atheist conventions and the kinds of things that I pay attention to there. So issues of marginalization within that community, because the geek community and geek culture is largely as much white boy as the atheist community has been. There's a lot of parallels there. Maybe it's not an exact one-to-one correlation, but there is a lot of parallels there.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan, and I'm speaking with Josiah Mannion about photography as a form of activism. A little later in this segment, Kim Ellington interviews Baba Brinkman about creating peer-reviewed rap music.
Within a lot of geek communities, there's been these really fantastic discussions of diversity, not just for the sake of diversity, but diversity because it's reflective and diversity because it gives people voices.
Because with more diversity comes more stories. And that's what a lot of geekdom is about.
And richer storytelling. We've had so many stories in sci-fi and fantasy. They talk about whitewashing all these characters, and that's a very real phenomenon. And people get uncomfortable then when you have Little Rue being actually seen as a black girl, but she is, and that's her voice. And then being able to turn around and tell all of these stories, and it forces you to tune your ear so that you're not hearing just the white boy's voice all the time.
The Rue comment, for those who are not geeks, is a Hunger Games reference. People were upset when the actress in the movie was black.
Yeah. And there was a lot of hullabaloo about that. And that's a pretty stark example, in particular because the character was actually, she was written that way. And she was written that way quite intentionally. And so then you begin not only to have the voices of these minor characters heard, but then you begin to see that there are all of these other stories where you have, you know, a woman of color, not just as a side character, but as the central character. And everything is told through that voice. So whereas in Hunger Games, it's still kind of a white girl's voice telling the story, there are still all of these other voices and characters that should have a home too. And when you go and you, and you're shooting at a conference and you're photographing at a conference and you see people dressing up and they're dressing up to be able to tell these stories, and being a photographer there gives you a chance to help get them to be able to tell their own stories. And they're fictionalized stories, and they're archetypal stories, and they're all of these different wonderful things, but it's still their story. So it's not just trying to make a geek community seem more normalized, but to normalize the variety of voices within it, within the geek community, so that it's not so monolithic and homogenous as well.
And that actually brings up discussions that have been fairly prominent recently in geek communities, where this isn't the first time that people have done this work to make everyone see women, to make everyone see people of color, particularly among writers. But here we are suddenly again talking as though the picture of geekdom is white men. Does it that kind of tendency ever get frustrating? Do you ever feel like you ever feel a little bit like Sisyphus?
Yes. Although I do have to acknowledge that, you know, I am a white boy, so it's not nearly as, or the way that it is frustrating to me is not as deeply and meaningfully frustrating as it is for the black woman trying to tell her story, because that literally is her life, and it's not literally my life. So the way that it's frustrating for me is frustrating in a much more meaningful and harmful way for them who still keep having to try to say, look, I have a voice. This is me. This is my story. And either have it dismissed or minimalized or actively harmed, because it's not, I mean, those things, it can go from, you know, from a passive shrug or whatever to the story to people actively seeking threat and harm to these people because they tried to tell their story. Because they tried to say that they're real, that their lives matter, that they have meaning. And so far from people just kind of shrugging that off and saying that their story matters, that the white boy story still matters, that can be very harmful, to be constantly told that your story doesn't matter and I don't have to experience that in the kind of real way that other people do. So, I mean, so yes, it is. It can be very frustrating, but how much more so to the people whose lives are actually being told that they don't matter?
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. Thank you for giving us a little insight into your process and a little bit of a teaser for what we should look for out of Reason Rally.
But thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Kim Ellington recorded this interview with Baba Brinkman this past October, but we haven't had a chance to bring it to you until now. Luckily for us, and you, Baba's music remains as entertaining and informative as it was last fall.
I'm at the Atheist Alliance of America conference. I'm outside one of the rooms speaking with Baba Brinkman, who I met 3 years ago, I think, at Rock Beyond Belief. And, you know, I've talked about it before. Rock Beyond Belief was an amazing event where we stood up as atheists and demanded equality with the folks that had Rock the Fort, which was an evangelical music fest. And one of our headliners at our Rock Beyond Belief was Baba Brinkman. Hello.
Well, hello. Great to see you again.
Yeah, you been doing anything since I saw you last 3 years ago?
Oh, you know, just sleeping in and binge-watching Netflix, releasing several albums and producing off-Broadway shows and, you know, trying to keep on the science rap communication warpath.
The science rap communication. Yeah, these things are important. People don't realize. All right, so you have a new album coming out.
I do. It's called Rap Guide to Religion, and it is adapted from an off-Broadway show that I did last winter. So Rap God to Religion ran in New York for 7 months. It was a New York Times critics pick, and it was nominated for a Drama Desk Award and got lots of accolades. And they contained several songs, and then I adapted other parts of the show into a bunch of other songs. So now I have a 15-track studio album that purports to tell the story of how religious instincts evolved in our species from their earliest kernels through to all of the contemporary manifestations of religion and faith and how it plays out in the real world and politics and everything. But it brings it back to its sort of evolutionary roots, both in genetics and in culture, and suggests ways that we can defuse that bomb by understanding its origins better.
Very nice. So speaking of evolution, the first of your albums that I heard was The Rap Guide to Evolution, which is absolutely amazing and very fun. My daughter, Danielle, was listening to Creationist Cousins, which is a little spoofy, very fun look at, I think she likes most that kind of pick on your relatives and yourself at the same time, but in a very cooperative way.
Yeah, and I come from a family that has lots of evangelical Christians and young earth creationists, and it's been part of the sort of family dinner table conversation since I was young, but we still all get along. There's no animosity. We go to family dinners and reunions together, and we set that aside. I was just fishing with my evangelical uncle a couple years ago, and we both know where we disagree, and sometimes we talk about it and other times we don't. And I think it's good practice for how to have cordial discussions with people in a way that doesn't degenerate into name-calling, but still can really confront major issues in a way that's sort of honest and respectful at the same time.
I like it. Tell us a little bit more about some of your other work.
Well, let's see, what have I done?
You have
last
several. You
years?
Have several albums. You have a lot of good stuff.
Cool. Since Rock Beyond Belief, I think I've put out 4 records. So there was one called the Infomatic EP, which was a little bit random. It was more like a kind of a collection of various songs. I was a songwriter in residence at the National Institute for Mathematical and Biological Synthesis in Knoxville, Tennessee, and they do computational biology research there, and they had me and my music producer friend Jamie stay with them for a month and attend a lot of science meetings and workshops and then try to synthesize their ideas into rap songs. So that was one record. I also produced a rap guide to wilderness last year, which is about ecology and biodiversity and conservation, and which is more of an environmentalist lean to it, but it also draws on the science of ecology as well. And also just, why is it important to preserve a species and not let it go extinct? The religious answer is because it's a unique creation of God, but that, seems to often carry the baggage with it that it was sort of given to us for us to dispose of as we see fit. A lot of religious people take that attitude towards nature. Or, if God created it once, then he could again, so no big deal. Whereas the evolutionary view is that it's a unique branch on a tree that if it dies out, there's really no way to restore it. And these sort of unique evolutionary designs are worth preserving because of their common heritage with us and because of their intrinsic value. And I said they'll never come back. Actually, one of the songs is called Bottleneck, and it's about the de-extinction movement and some of the new research that's potentially going to bring us back a passenger pigeon or maybe even a mammoth, which would be kind of cool.
Wouldn't it?
And let's see, there was a rap guide to medicine, which I produced last spring, which is about evolutionary medicine and how disease can be understood via one of a few different evolutionary paradigms, either an arms race between us trying to maximize our fitness and parasites trying to maximize theirs. That's one evolutionary way to understand disease, or also mismatches and trade-offs where we don't have an environment today like the one we evolved in, and our bodies have gone through processes where we had to trade reproduction for survival, and that has left us vulnerable as something that evolution has shaped in us, and that can lead to new research questions and approaches to treating disease. So that's what that record's about. Rap Guide to Religion is about to come out, and I've also just written and premiered Rap Guide to Climate Chaos at the Edinburgh Fringe. So I got a new one about climate change as well. When I lay out my recent projects, I'm realizing that I'm way too prolific for my fan base. At this rate, I'm going to average 3 listeners per project if I keep putting them up that fast. But, you know, got to keep on your toes.
You do. Yeah, you do. So with the Rap Guide to Religion, are you focusing specifically on one religion or is it kind of to the whole concept?
I really try to avoid focusing on any one religion. And, you know, some of the reviews said it was a little bit too Abrahamic religion centric because I probably talk about Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, reference them more in the show than Eastern religions. But those are also the ones that the majority of the people that I interact with are contending with. So it seemed like, you know, natural for my audience. But I was raised around more Eastern religions, so I do reference them quite a bit in the album as well, like Buddhism and Taoism and Jainism and Hinduism and that kind of stuff. But, you know, the idea is that it's supposed to be themes and trends that are applicable to all religions. So what are their commonalities? And generally, the commonalities between them are more likely to have a basis in genetic evolution and in our sort of cognitive architecture and evolved instincts. And the differences between them are more likely to have a cultural evolutionary explanation where memes have diverged in the same way that we have different words for the same thing. We have different ideas about what God is and wants. But there are ways to look at those phenomenon as evolutionary products as well. One of the songs is called Fertility Gods, and it's about how religion all through, well, for the last 10,000 years anyway, has really been in the business of promoting fertility and reproduction, which has not been great for women or their liberty, but it might have been adaptive at the level of whole cultures, because larger societies tend to win in conflicts with smaller societies. So if a society evolves the norms and the messaging in their religious beliefs that the bigger the family you have, the better, and the more time you spend in the house being a mother versus having other pursuits, the better. That can evolve, even if there's no sort of Machiavellian designer of this oppressive system. It can actually just come from what they call cultural group selection. Groups that have those beliefs tend to prevail over groups that don't, and that's why those beliefs become so prevalent.
Interesting. So do you, all these different subjects that you rap on and put out these wonderful records, do you research each one of them going into it? Or is it, do you get a subject that you're interested in and then suddenly the words come?
No, I do the whole album and then I try to see if I was right.
No, that's good.
No.
Do you make it right? Rewrite a few
papers.
It's
all just guesswork. I call it peer-reviewed rap because I really do go into it with the intention that I'm going to communicate this field or this concept or this idea in as scientifically accurate a way as possible. So for each of them, I will have expert fact checkers who are the primary researchers in the field. So Rap Guide to Religion, I sent copies of the script to Ara Nouronzian, who's at UBC. His book is called Big Gods and was a big influence on it. Jonathan Haidt, who wrote The Righteous Mind. David Sloan Wilson, who wrote Darwin's Cathedral. And John Tehan has got a great book called In the Name of God about the evolution of religious conflict and violence. Getting their feedback and changing the lyrics is what gives me the ability to say this is peer-reviewed rap that you're listening to. And I can really stand behind what I'm saying.
That's awesome. So where would our listeners find your peer-reviewed rap?
Well, if you Google Baba Brinkman, that's BABABRINKMAN, that's probably the easiest way. And Rap Guide to Religion is about to be out on iTunes and Bandcamp and wherever fine digital music is sold.
Excellent. Perfect. Baba, thank you for being here with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
As mentioned in our interview with Josiah, this Saturday is the Reason Rally in Washington, D.C. The Reason Rally is the largest gathering of non-believers in the U.S., and possibly the world. We're coming together to show politicians, who have spent the last several decades catering to religious people and to a conservative religious agenda that is anything but humanist, that we are a large, engaged demographic whose political concerns should be heard. Don't worry, though. We're not asking you to stand outside for a full day of politics. As important as the issues are, we're offering you some entertainment, too. Start your day at 10 a.m. with music, or end it at 7 p.m. the same way. In between, listen to entertainers, activists, and yes, politicians, talk about the value of secular politics. Meet other non-believers from across the country and across the world. Find out how you can get involved in secular activism. If you can make it, come out to the Lincoln Memorial this Saturday, June 4th. Make it for all or part of the day. We just want to see you there, and we want the rest of the country to see you as well. The American Humanist Association is a major sponsor of the Reason Rally. For more information about us and what we do beyond the Humanist Hour, come visit us during the rally. For more information on the Reason Rally itself, or the other events of the weekend, visit reasonrally.org. We hope you can join us. As always, we value your feedback on the show. Have a comment or question for today's guests? Have a suggestion for a guest you'd like us to interview? Email us at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Thank you again for listening to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association.